Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to be here, and thank you for inviting me. I've actually been wanting to come to Skokie for over 20 years. It's true, because in high school, I don't know if it's still around, but there was a summer camp, which was half Torah and half computer programming. And I love learning Torah, and I love computer programming. And the way it was described to me by my brother, who had gone a few years before, is that you spend most of the half the day Torah, half the day computer programming, and then at the end of the day, you go outside for about 10 minutes to make believe you're playing baseball, to take pictures, to send back home, to say, yeah, we also did physical activity, which is exactly my kind of camp, because I don't really like playing sports. So I really wanted to go, but then all my friends made fun of me for going to a nerdy computer camp, and I decided not to go. I gave in to peer pressure, and I still regret not coming to Skokie for that. So I feel like today, coming here to talk about Torah, and I'll mention some computer programming also, is my catharsis, and so finally I get to be here. I want to talk about one of my favorite topics, which is the Keter Aram Tzava, the Aleppo Codex. My grandparents are from Chaleb, from Aleppo. So this is a story that's near and dear to my heart. But I'd like to start the story in 1947, on November 29th. Everybody knows why that date is famous, obviously, because that was the day that Kondo had a meeting with Professor Sukenik, right? I think that was the most significant event of that day. You agree?
No.
Well, let me tell you about that event. Maybe I'll change your mind. So if you look at the first page here, what happened on that day? Well, a few months earlier, there were some Bedouin boys that were attending to their goats in the Judean hills, and one of the goats, you know this famous story, went into the cave and he threw a rock and heard something shatter and went in and found some ancient manuscripts, didn't know what they were, but he had a sense that these might be valuable, so he brought them to a shoemaker / antiquities dealer. I don't know why they go together, but I guess shoes are made out of leather and scrolls are made out of leather, so he figured that this guy Kondo would be a good person to give them to. Kondo gave him a few dollars, now Kondo had in his hands the first seven of the Dead Sea Scrolls that were found in the first cave. And Kondo also didn't know their value, didn't really know what they were, but he did contact an Israeli archaeologist named Professor Eliezer Sukenik. And he said, I have something you might be interested in. And he was interested. At this time, it was still under the British mandate. But Professor Sukenik went undercover. We talked about Shalach Lecha, right? Talk about the spies. And he drove at some risk to himself into the West Bank and met with Kondo and purchased there on November 29th, the first three of those seven scrolls that went into the hands of for the Hebrew University, for the State of Israel. Why is this so significant? Well, I'll tell you why. It also happens to be the day that the UN voted on their partition, right? And this is really amazing, because why were the scrolls put there in the first place? Well, 2,000 years ago, the Jews that were living there saw that the Romans are coming. They had already destroyed the north. They're coming down. They're going to destroy the Beit HaMikdash, eventually destroy Masada, the last stand. And they said, this is the end, right? Is there going to be any Jewish survival? But they said, you know what? Maybe some Jews will survive. And they're going to need our most sacred texts. So let's put them in these jars for safekeeping, for long term. And maybe one day, Jews were able to come back here, and they'll find these jars, and they'll find our most sacred writings. And sure enough, they remain in those jars intact for 2,000 years, and they're found just before, in 1947, and the very same day, almost the same hour, that Israel becomes a state, is when these scrolls come back into Jewish hands. So, really, these two events go together. Okay, so this is really significant in terms of the State of Israel, but also in terms of our knowledge of Tanakh. So if we ask ourselves, how do we know what the text of Tanakh is? So now we take it for granted, we just go to the bookshelf, and we open a Tanakh. Right, but how did it come to us over all those centuries? And when we found the Dead Sea Scrolls, we found copies of every book of Tanakh, not entirely, some of them are only small bits, and we're missing one book, the book of Esther. Maybe that's on purpose. Maybe they didn't like the book of Esther. Or maybe it's just by mistake because it's a pretty small book and maybe there was a little piece and one extra worm ate it. That's a different story. We could talk about that next Purim. But in any case, we found some pieces of every single book. Some books we found dozens of copies. The most popular book was Tehillim, a few dozen copies of that. And what we have now are copies of the Torah and Tanakh that are 2,000 years old. Which is really amazing because that's much older than any other manuscript that we had before we found the Dead Sea Scrolls. And I guess you assume as a rule of thumb, the older the manuscript, the more accurate, right? Wouldn't you assume that? Not necessarily. Okay, so we'll see. We'll talk about that. So one of the copies, one of the fragments that we did find was on the bottom of the page. You could look along with me. This is it's called the Psalm Scroll. It's a copy of a few Mizmorim from Tehillim. If you look on the right-hand column, right in the middle of the page, you can all read it. I mean, the copy came out not so great, but you can still make it out. Tefillah al David, Adam Mimcha, Hashem, Elokai HaMelech, Va'abarecha, Shimcha, Le'olam Va'ed. Okay, sound familiar, right? What we call Ashrei. It's a little bit different. It says Tefillah instead of Tehillah. Le David is spelt differently, right? You see, it says Lamed Dalid, Vav Yud Dalid. Okay, so that's called Ketiv Male, spelling it with the Yud. If you look in our Tanakh, it's spelled just Dalid, Vav, Dalid, without the Yud, which is called Ketiv Chaser. It's lacking these vowel letters. So what happened over time is, originally, the word David's name was spelled Dalid, Vav, Dalid. My son's name, right? That's how we spell it. But then over time, because they didn't have Nikudot weren't added till much later. So it's really, it could be hard to read. How do you pronounce that? Is it Dod? Is it Dude? It could be pronounced many ways. So scribes would add in vowel letters, Alephs, Hays, Vavs, Yuds, to make it easier to read. And in fact, even in Tanakh, if you compare an early book, like Shemuel or Melachim, always says Dalet Vav Dalet. Compare it to Divrei Yamim, almost always spells it Dalet Vav Yud Dalet. Right? So you can see the development of language, of spelling, over time. So this is a good rule of thumb. The more imot ha-kriyah, the more vowel letters, the later the text is. So this text has yuds and has lots of other vowel letters. If you see that word, Tefillah David Adam Mimcha, the next word that has dots on top and bottom is actually Hashem's name, Yud Ke Vav Ke, but it's spelt in Kitav Ivri, in ancient Hebrew, Paleo Hebrew. So this is what Hebrew looked like way back before the time of Ezra. Even though scribes moved over to the new script that we use today, but for Hashem's name, they didn't want to change it, just because the shape of those letters had Kiddusha in itself. So throughout this text, only Hashem's name is in the old script, and the rest is in the new script. So you find all kinds of amazing things when you look at these Dead Sea Scrolls. Here's one more before we leave this text. If you look on the left side, all the way on top, on the second line, at the end of the line, it says Ne'eman. Well, before that, it says, on top of the line, it says, Malchut Techa in the middle. Malchut Kol Olamim, Memshal Techa Bechol Dor Vador, Baruch Hashem, Baruch Shemol Olam Va'ed. After every pasuk, it adds, Baruch Hashem, Baruch Shemol Olam Va'ed. It sounds like this is actually not a book of Tehillim, but a prayer book. And the Chazan would say the pasuk, and everybody would answer after each pasuk, Baruch Hashem, Baruch Shemol Olam Va'ed. Right? So, now after, this is the Mem pasuk, Malchut Techa, what comes next? What comes next in our Ashrei? Samech, right? It skips over noon. It's supposed to be Samech, but instead we have here Ne'eman Elokim Bidvarav V'chasid Bechol Ma'asav. What do you know? A pasuk for noon, right? So most scholars, when they saw this, they said, here it is, the original missing noon, right? And they were so happy to find this. And so go ahead and we can now go correct all of our Sidurim. Right? You think that would be a good idea? No, why not? Here it is. The oldest copy, 2,000 years old, original handwriting, has the Nun Pasuk. Why shouldn't it be there?
There's a different Masorah.
There is a different Misarah. And so I agree with you. I think there's something suspicious actually about this pasuk. I'll say it again. Ne'man Elokim bidvarav v'chasid b'chol ma'asav. Sound familiar? Right? That's also the ending for Sadi. Sadiq Hashem b'chol derechav v'chasid b'chol ma'asav. Okay, so what looks like actually happened is the scribe, maybe not the scribe, but whoever he was copying from, somewhere along the line, noticed that there's a nun pasuk, assumed there was a mistake, and decided to fix it. But he wasn't so creative, so he just took a piece of this pasuk and a piece of that pasuk and put it together and added the pasuk, and that way made it better. Okay, you find this a lot in the Dead Sea Scroll Bible manuscripts, that they all kinds of things that they perceive as a problem, rather than write a commentary, you know, Rashi or Midrash, they just put their comments right into the text. And this happens a lot, so that's why you can't always trust, or even usually trust, the Dead Sea Scrolls. Okay, but this leads us to then the next problem. If we can't trust the Dead Sea Scrolls, then where should we look for the most authentic copy of the Tanakh? Any ideas? Well, the answer is going to be the Aleppo Codex, right? But I want to drill down further, a little bit further, about the problem of how to... Aleppo Codex is 1,000 years old. So it's relatively recent, right? How did it get from antiquity down to 1,000 years ago? What about that? So I want to challenge you with this question, and if anybody knows computers, you could bring those skills to bear. How do you make an exact copy of a text before the age of computers, before you have photocopy machines? What do you do? How do you publish a text and get it out there? Because we know human error is just natural. Even Sofrim today, write it by hand. The Torah has 80,000 words in it. So even if a scribe is 99% accurate, right, that means there's still going to be 800 mistakes, which is still way too much, right? Even if he's 99.9% accurate, still going to be lots of mistakes. You mentioned one of the rabbis at Sherith Israel, which is the oldest congregation, not the oldest building, but the oldest congregation in America, and we have a constitution that's 200 years old, which we still abide by. It gets into all kinds of problems sometimes. One of the rules in the constitution is that the chazan is responsible for checking the Sefer Torah before he reads. And if it turns out that there's a mistake in the Torah while he's reading, the chazan is fined $5, which was a lot of money, right? But if he checks it beforehand and finds a mistake before, then he's rewarded with $5, right? Well, sure enough, just this year on Chol HaMoed Pesach, the chazan was reading, not me, the other chazan, and actually found an entire word mistake in our Sefer Torah. And so we had to close it up and bring out a new one. And we had to pay $5, right? So this really happens. I mean, Sefer Torah do have mistakes in them. I mean, isn't that, how can you get past human error? Today we do computer checks, but even computer checks catch certain things and not other things. Okay, so that's your challenge. You are challenged, right? Moshe gives you, here's the Torah, and now you have to pass it on to the next generation. What are you going to do?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, excellent. Oral tradition can be very strong, and in some ways stronger than written. And that's certainly true for the Gemara. Mishnah, Gemara were all memorized by heart, even into the times of the Geonim. There's one letter, the Geonim in Bavel, they used to raise money, people would send in she'elot, and they would send a check into, right? And then they would send back brochures. And one of their letters, kind of their brochure, says, "Our yeshiva is so fantastic, we don't even have one book in the whole building." Because they knew everything by heart. And in fact, in the yeshivot, if someone did have some written notes, sometimes there were some written copies, and it conflicted with the oral tradition, there was these tana'im, professional memorizers. They always went with the oral tradition. That was considered better than the written, because written can actually make more mistakes than an oral tradition. So you're right, that would be a very good idea. The problem is that a lot of the time, it's just a matter of spelling. And the word is pronounced like David, is pronounced the same way, so the Chazan knows by heart, wouldn't necessarily know if it should be a Yud or not be a Yud there, right? But that's information that we still want to know. Okay, good. So how would you do it? How would you preserve the exact copy of the text?
You have to have a standard.
Okay, good.
And you copy from the standard all the time.
Excellent, fantastic, right? Even today, we have there's a Bureau of Standards and Measures. They have the exact foot there, an exact pound. That's the definition of a foot and a pound. And you can take your ruler there and go and compare it and make sure your ruler is really correct, right? We have atomic clocks that are keeping exact time, and we can check all of our clocks based on that. So you have one exact copy. Where would you keep it?
Safe place.
In a safe place? Right. So it was kept, this is what was done. It was kept in the Beit HaMikdash, right? The perfect copy was kept there, and then copies were made from that and distributed to Jews everywhere else. Now, those copies, do they have mistakes in them? They might, right? They probably do. But that's okay, because if two people, they're reading and says, this looks suspicious, I remember another copy, there's something going on here. They'll just write a letter or try to go to the Beit HaMikdash, ask the Kohanim, can you check this? Oh, here's the right one. And they'll go back and fix it. Right? So it's a pretty good system, wouldn't you say?
No Beit HaMikdash.
Oh, afterward, yeah. Okay, eventually there's no Beit HaMikdash. But you can still have a master copy. Actually, the Aleppo Codex was used as a master copy. And this was the standard way of using other books also. The Rambam, his copy of Mishneh Torah, there were copies of that, but he had his autograph copy. This is the correct one, and you should correct all other copies based on that one. So that's a good system. The problem with the system is that eventually, over many centuries, even that original is going to wear out and is going to have to be copied. And if you look all the way on the back page, source number one on top, tells us that this was a real problem. And then, in fact, Me'onai Elohe Kedem, this is from the Sifre, a Tanaitic Midrash, right? A very important source, says, Shelosha Sifarim Nimsi'u Ba'azara. There were actually three Sifre Torah that were in the Azara that were almost the same, but they had some differences. Echad Shem Me'onim, Ve'echad Shel Hi-Hi, Ve'echad Nikra Sefer Za'atutim. And then it further explains, it says, Be'echad ketiv ma'on eloke kedem, u'bishtayim ketiv me'ona eloke kedem, which is actually just a ketiv chaser or ketiv male, because even ma'on you could pronounce me'ona as if it had a kamatz on the end. So, but anyways, two different spellings. One of them had ma'on without a hey. Two of them had me'ona with a hey. And so then they didn't know what to do. So what did they decide? They followed the majority. Majority is probably right. Is it necessarily right? Could be that the minority one has it right. But what could they do? There were three master copies, and they followed that. Other places, sometimes the word who is spelled, sometimes the word hey, vav, aleph is pronounced he. Right? Kedir tiv, it comes up many times. How many of them are there in the Torah? That was also a difference. Just yesterday, I happened to read the parasha, and there's one word that has a yud. That is pronounced, it's written as a vav, but it's pronounced as a yud. So we have the yuds were written kind of elongated, so it's easy to make a mistake between a vav and a yud. So those were also different between the copies. So we have here the problem that even the master copy has to be copied, and there will be small differences between those also. So we need a better system. Can anybody think of a better system? Computers, yes. Computers is a better system. In fact, when computers came out, this was itself a difficulty. I'll just tell you personal. So it happens to me that my father-in-law is a big computer. He always has the latest gadgets. Going back to the 80s, he had the first IBM PC XT, first personal computer. And he was very interested in having a digital, searchable copy of Tanakh. For some of his own Bible research. He sells children's wear, but he hasn't gone to work in about 30 years because he likes studying Bible better. So he actually found a monk who entered in all of the Tanakh with grammatical tags, And so he bought the data from him and went to YU, because YU had a mainframe that could process the data, and managed to get all that data onto a laptop, which in those days meant a big suitcase that you roll around, right? And he brought it to a big Bible conference where there were universities also working on the same thing, and he had the most advanced computer software that could have the Tanakh and be searchable. But even there, you had to go through it and double check, and there were mistakes. And well, how do you know which one is right? Which one are the right letters? So, computers can help once you have a text, but we still need a text before that. But I think computers can help a different way. You remember when Al Gore invented the internet? That the purpose of the internet was to get a message from New York to California, right? Even in the event of a national catastrophe, that if phone lines this way went down, there will be multiple paths. And the idea is redundancy. Okay, you need many ways to get to the same place, to get the same data. If anybody knows computer science, you know that every byte has 8 bits, but one of those bits is just a check bit. Right? It's just there to make sure that it counts how many other bits are, is it even or odd, and lets you know. Because back when I was in college, we still used modems over phone lines. They're kind of staticky, and mistakes could actually happen, even in computers, and you get the wrong, right? An on could be turned into an off. So you need that redundancy, the same message twice, or same information twice, to check it to make sure that it's correct the second time. Okay, so that's the idea. We want some way to encode all the information of Tanakh in a way that will be redundant, so that if one thing, someone makes a mistake in one place, you can find out what the mistake was in another place. Got it? So how are we going to do that? Well, the Baalei HaMesorah, these are the people that were responsible for transmitting the Tanakh from one generation to the next. These were families from went from father to son, who were trained in how to do this, came up with an ingenious system that we can find in the Keter, I'm sorry, in the Aleppo Codex. So if you turn to the third page, there's a copy of one page from the Keter Aram Tzava. Aram Tzava is another name for Chalab, another name for Aleppo. Right? It's called the Keter because it was the crown. Not that one, it's this one here. That's two columns. Okay. So this is the codex. I should explain what the word codex means, right? Anybody know? What's codex? Okay, codex is just a fancy word for a book. But the book is actually one of the greatest inventions of all time, because before that you had the scrolls, right? And the problem with the scroll is... If you're all the way in Bereshit and you want to look up something in Dvarim, right, you have to get 3 friends to come and help you roll for 10 minutes till you get to the end. Whereas a book, you can just jump to any page in the book, right? That's one advantage. Second advantage of a codex, or a book over a scroll, is you can write double-sided, right? You can write both sides of the page. Whereas a scroll, right, the back is useless. So you could save parchment that way. The Romans invented it around the 1st, 2nd century CE, and this really changed the way people read. So for ritual purposes, we obviously still use a scroll, and in the rest of our lives, we're also going back to tablets and scrolling and all that, right? Technology is being reversed. But a codex, a book, is a great invention. So this is not a kosher Sefer Torah. It has nikudot and ta'amim, trup. But it can't be used for reading in Bet Knesset. But the purpose is for study, for learning. So I want to show you how this works. First of all, just note how beautiful the text is, how beautiful the letters are, and the nekudot, and so much detail that goes into it. This was written in the year 930 CE by the Baal HaMesorah, Aharon ben Asher, the ben Asher family. And this is a copy of Tehillim. And if you look on the left-hand column right in the middle, you could read it with me, Tefillah LeMoshe, Ish Elohim, right? Adonai Ma'on Ata Yitalan Bedor Vador Betedam Harim Yuladu Batecholel Eres VeTebel Me'olam Adolam Ata El. One thing that's beautiful about this is that it's It's there's space between each phrase, right? So it's in two columns, so you can actually see the parallelism that's everywhere in Tehillim. There's very few modern Tanakhs that are printed this way. Rav Royer, one of my teachers, did print a Tanakh in this way, but it hasn't been when they reprinted it. They didn't do it as well. So it's really nice to have that poetry. In fact, the Aleppo Codex, everywhere else in Tanakh, has three columns on the page. But for Tehillim, there's only two columns on the page because they want to have enough room to have the entire line and the parallelism. Okay, good. So it's very nice, Teshev Enosh Ad Daka, and so on. Now, what you notice here that's different from a Tanakh that you would pick up today is you see all the letters in the margins? And then there's more words on the top and bottom margins, right? What is all that stuff? What is going on there? So this is called the Masoretic Notes. And the one that's in between the margins is called Mesorah Ketana. And the one that's above and below the page is called Masorah Gedola. And these are the codes that have the redundancy built into them. I want to show you one example of how this works. So you see the word Daka that's circled? You see how the word Daka, the word Daka is spelled? Dalet, Kaf, Aleph. Okay. That's very good. If we look, there's a little circle on top of the Kaf, right? Which is not a Tam, right? The Tam is already there on the bottom. That circle is kind of like a footnote telling you to look on the side. And if you look all the way in the side, the arrow is pointing to a small Gimel. And that small Gimel says, this word is spelled in exactly this way, three times, Gimel, three times throughout the Tanakh, including this one. Okay, so that's some good information. Now, if you happen to not know Tanakh by heart with old spellings, and you might need a little help of where it is, oh, no problem. Look on the bottom, and it tells you, all the way in the bottom, Mesorah Gedolah, the arrow, and the box, it says Daka Gimel, and it tells you the Pasuk, Lo Yavo Pitsua Daka, which is a Pasuk in Sefer Dvarim. Okay? And it says over there also, it's the word is spelled with an aleph. And one other time is also, from Yeshayahu, is also spelled with an aleph. So, this is brilliant. Because what does this mean? Let's say a scribe will come one day, and instead of writing it with an aleph, we'll write it with a hey. Right? But he's also going to copy the Masoretic Notes and copy that gimel. So then, maybe 100, maybe 500 years later, someone will come and say, says gimel, but I'm looking through and I see only two of them are spelt with an aleph, and one of them is spelt with a hey. So the notes don't match the text. Well, they'll do some investigation, and look at all the notes, and all the places where it should be, and they'll see gimel over there where the one's a mistake, and you recalculate everything, and you find out that that's a mistake. And then you fix it. Right? Sometimes mistakes can happen when copying the Masoretic Notes. Right? Instead of writing gimel, you didn't have enough coffee, and he writes a dalet instead. And now he thinks, oh, there's supposed to be four of them. He's looking through a Tanakh, and says doesn't find them. But he will find that in the other places where it says daka, it also says gimel, and gives you the other two pesukim. So once you know all that information, right, then you obviously know that this one is a mistake. So every single, eventually encodes a few million data points. And each one is overlapped, encoded multiple times, sometimes dozens of times. So any one mistake will not go unnoticed and will be easy. I mean, I say easy, it might take you a few days to figure it out. You have to be a real expert in how these codes work, but they work, and this way it preserves the text exactly. Yes?
Real quick, would you say the present Tanakh that we read, whether it be Art Scroll or just a plain Chumash, is via codex?
Okay, that's a great, very important question. The short answer is no. But I will, let me explain, okay? Because there's a longer story there. But don't worry, okay? I'll explain it. This is the Aleppo Codex. The Aleppo Codex is not the only codex with the Masoretic Notes. There are many others as well. The second best is the Leningrad Codex. It was written a little bit later and was actually corrected off of the Aleppo Codex. It's now Leningrad, that's why it's called that. And there are many others also. In medieval times, a lot of people forgot what these codes even are, but they just liked them because they look decorative, and they would just write random letters letters, right, around the edges of their Bible manuscripts, just to make them look nice, right? But those aren't useful at all.
JB has just sold a copy of Megillat Esther from the First Gutenberg Press, and you're saying that the Megillat Esther was absent in the Dead Sea Scrolls.
That's right.
Where is the origin of that First Gutenberg Press edition of Megillat Esther?
Okay, well, the oldest Megillat Esther would be the Aleppo Codex. Yeah, right. Although it's missing. Wait, I'll get there too. Okay.
So this is from 1,000 years ago.
Correct.
Okay, but the Torah is older than 1,000.
Correct.
Years. So where's the Aleppo code for 2,000 years?
We don't have it. There obviously were many, many manuscripts.
All it says is that we have a way of figuring it out for just the last 1,000 years, but we don't know if it was correct from 2,000 years ago.
That's right. We don't have any. We have the Dead Sea Scrolls. If you compare the Aleppo Codex with the Dead Sea Scrolls, one from 1,000 years old, one from 2,000 years old, what you can tell is that the Aleppo Codex preserves an older version of the text than the Dead Sea Scrolls, because one way we know is there are many less vavs and yuds and imot hakriyah, many, many less in the Aleppo Codex than in the Dead Sea Scrolls. That's one indication of the authenticity of the Aleppo Codex. So you're right, it's only written 1,000 years ago, and we don't have any other Masoretic text older than that, but we can tell that it's a really, really good text. Right? Better than the 2,000-year-old ones. Okay, good. Let me tell you a little bit about the story of this codex itself. I mentioned that it was written in the year 930 in Tiberia, by the Ben Asher family, who were the top. There were other families also. Ben Naphtali had small differences, like we say, Li Yerushalayim, right? The Ben Naphtali, on a whole other school, they would say, Li Yerushalayim, right? And they had endless fights about this. Okay, but we don't have to worry about that. This codex was then actually bought by the Karaite community in Jerusalem. Something absolutely amazing is that the Karaites and the Rabbanites, even though they disagreed about every point of halacha and Torah Sheba'al Peh, but for Torah Shebichtav, they agreed on the same exact text. They both used the Aleppo Codex. Some people think that the Ben Ashers who wrote it might have been Karaites themselves. No absolute proof either way, but truth is it doesn't really matter because everybody agreed on the same version of the text. So the Karaites had this in the 11th century and they used it. But then the Crusades come, and the Crusaders in 1099 take the Codex, not because they're particularly interested in it, but because they know that the Jews will buy it back. If you look on top of the page here, it says Lo Yigael, right? On the other opposite page, it says Lo Yimacher, the Lo Yigael. This may not be sold and may not be redeemed. So they make a right. We will not redeem it if you steal it. Obviously we will, right? But we declare that we won't because we want to discourage anyone from stealing it in the first place. So the Crusaders steal it, and the Rabbinite community in Egypt puts together some money, and they redeem it. And they even write, we redeemed many of the books, and some of the people too, right? Like the people are secondary to these most important books. So then it's in Cairo, and who else lives in Cairo? The Rambam, okay? And the Rambam uses this codex as his Tanakh. And he writes a Sefer Torah, and he says, I wrote my Sefer Torah based on this book, this work. I'll get back to the Rambam, hopefully in a few minutes. And after the Rambam, it goes into the Maimonidean family, who eventually in the 1400s moved to Aleppo. And there it stays for the next 600 years. It's the prized treasure of the Jews of Aleppo. They keep it safe. They actually originally put it in the storeroom with the oil. Oil is very expensive, which is not such a great place, turns out, because one time there was almost a fire, and then they decided to move it out, and where it was kept for at least the last 100 or 200 years was in the Great Synagogue in Aleppo. The Great Synagogue, you can see pictures of it. Well, I can't have them here. In the Great Synagogue of Aleppo is actually very interesting to me because I grew up in the Syrian community with Middle Eastern traditions, but now I'm the rabbi at the Spanish-Portuguese Synagogue, which is totally different customs and tunes. But the Jews that originally kicked out of Spain, a lot of them made their way to Aleppo, and they didn't get along so well with the locals. And in the Great Synagogue, they actually had two different rooms separated by a courtyard where they had two different minyanim, one according to the original Middle Eastern tradition, another according to the Spanish-Portuguese tradition. And they kept separate for centuries. And then eventually they got along. So in this Great Synagogue, there was a back room called the Cave of Eliyahu. And they had the Aleppo Codex there inside a metal safe. The community there really more venerated it than studied it. If people were sick or needed a marriage or needed children, they would go there, light candles, and pray near it. It seems that it was brought out for use once a year on Yom Kippur to read Yonah, Haftarat Yonah from it. Right, so most of the community is kind of treated as a holy object. There were though many rabbis that recognized its significance, and one is Rabbi Menashe Setehon, who is related to my wife's family, and we have letters from him. People would write letters to Aleppo from all around the world and saying, "Can you check the codex? Can you check this word and that word? What's the nekudot here? What are the ta'amim there?" And he would write back the letters. What was in there? So it was there in the early 1900s. Some people went to go visit it. One of the people that went to check it out was Yitzhak Ben Tzvi, who would become the president of Israel. He was very interested in the culture and of Sephardic Jews. Another person that went to visit it was Professor Umberto Cossuto. Umberto Cossuto, very famous and important Italian Bible scholar. Probably one of the only religiously observant Bible, Jewish Bible scholars of his generation. And he was in the Hebrew University. And at the Hebrew U, they said, you know what, we have lots of Tanakhs, but the printings are not good. There's all mistakes, all kinds of mistakes in them. If you want to see an example of a mistake, look on page 2. All the way on top. Let me see if you can, and can anybody here find the mistake? It's Parashat Pinchas. Very good. You found it right away. Okay, you can come check out Sifrei Torah.
Last word on the first line.
On the first line, the last word. Lifnei Nisim v'kol ha'eda. It says Pesach ol moed. Right? Obviously, it has nothing to do with Passover, but Petach, the opening. So this is a kind of just basic printing error that only an Ashkenazi could make. Right? I don't mean that as an insult. It just happens to be that. That's only right. Okay. And right. So this is an obvious mistake. I mean, this is not has no validity whatsoever. But all these kinds of mistakes happen in actual printed editions. If you want others that are more difficult to figure out on the bottom of this. This is a Gemara in Masechet Shabbat. It's talking about Pinchas, the son of Eli. Happens to also be Pinchas. Did he sin or not? I mean, the Sefer Shmuel says that he sinned, but it says no, he didn't sin. His brother Chofni, he's the one that sinned. And how do we know? Because it says Yishkivun, but Yishkivun is plural, it has a vav, so therefore they both sin. And then the Gemara says no, it doesn't have a vav. It says Yishkivan, which is singular, so only one of them sinned, not the other. So, all right, fine. But if you look at Tosfot on the top where the arrow is, it says Hashas Shelanu Cholek Al Sefarim Shelanu. Says the Gemara is different from the copies of Chumash that we Tanakh that we have, because our Tanakh in fact does have a vav, and the Gemara didn't have a vav there. And then it brings a few more examples, and Gilyon HaShas brings a few dozen examples of this, where the Gemara makes a drasha based on some letter that is found or not found in other copies of the Tanakh. Right? So this is a major problem to figure out what's going on. And so for this reason, these scholars that got together at Hebrew University said, we want to make a new Tanakh that's going to be absolutely perfect. Where should we look? The Aleppo Codex. So they send that one of the only guy that's Sephardic and observant to go there. Maybe he could get that information. So he does arrive in Aleppo and he says, "Can I see the codex?" And they said, "Oh, of course, we will let you see it for 15 minutes." It's like 15 minutes. I need to make a whole Tanakh based on this. It's not going to work. The rabbis there were extremely protective and be overprotective of it. They had some good reason to be overprotective because there were people that did try to take it. In the 1800s, there was a person named Abraham Firkovich. He was a very important Karaite book collector. He wanted to collect any book that had to do with Karaites that showed the antiquity of the Karaites. If it happens to be that the manuscript didn't, he would sometimes change it to make it look like the Karaites were more ancient than they were. Luckily, he used red crayon whenever he did that, so we can easily tell what was going on. Anyway, he came to Aleppo one time in the 1800s and somehow was able to get into and saw the codex and actually tried to take it. But they caught him in time, and they kicked him out. So the rabbis really didn't let anybody in. They actually had, you know, how the nuclear missiles need two keys, right? That's the system they had in the lock of the Cave Eliyahu. There was a shamash, and someone else had two different keys, and he needed both of them to be there to open the safe. So finally, after Kusoto pleaded, and many meetings, he was able to sit down with the codex for a few days. Until he had to go back because of personal family problems. I actually had the privilege of teaching his great-great-granddaughter in my class in Stern College. Professor Kusuda actually has a sad story. His daughter was in Auschwitz while he was in Israel and survived and made it to Israel. And then was on a bus going to Haaretz Sofim, and the bus blew up, and she died on the bus. That's whole just another amazing and sad story. So Professor Kusuda was able, while he was in Aleppo, to take some notes, and he did look up key passages and wrote them down, and wrote down the colophon, the introduction, and then he had to go back. Several other people also went during the years and made notes of what they saw.
Why did they photograph?
That's a great question. Excuse me. There actually were two people that did make photographs that are printed. One was William Wickes, who wrote a travel book in 1910. Take one picture and is printed in his travel book. Professor Kusuda wanted to copy it, wanted to photograph it, and it seems that they did not let him. It was also difficult to find film. The middle of the war, and I guess the rabbis who were in charge of it felt like photocopying it would diminish its value. They didn't, unfortunately. Okay, let's go back to November 29th again. We already saw two significant events that happened, but there was yet another. Even though it was a very happy day, in that we got our hands on some of the Dead Sea Scrolls and the decision to create the State of Israel happened. But in the Arab countries all over, Arabs rioted, including in Aleppo. This is on the next day. And they burnt down, destroyed many Jewish businesses. And they came to the great synagogue of Aleppo and tore it apart and set it aflame. And the next day, the shamash of the synagogue came there with his son, and he found that they had gotten the safe and tore the safe open, and the Aleppo Codex was ripped apart, and pages were all over the place. And he gathered together as many pages as he could, and he took the whole thing and put it into hiding. Because he knew the Syrian government might come and take it, and actually hid it with a non-Jewish store owner, and then it was transferred later to a Jewish store owner, and very few people even knew that any of it survived. In fact, in newspapers in Israel, Umberto Cusuto wrote an article talking about how terrible it is that this most important copy of Tanakh is lost. Turns out it was around. And we know now that it was entirely intact. Growing up myself, I remember hearing that it was burnt. But in fact, a few years ago, scientists did some checking, and they found that the brown burn marks, I don't know if you can see them on this page, that are on the edges, are not actually burn marks at all, but rather fungus. So it seems that the fire did not damage the codex at all, and it was intact, but they needed to get it out. And in 1958, they had a great opportunity. There was a man named Murad Faham, who happens to be my wife's great uncle. That's why I married her. he was a cheese merchant in Aleppo. He also did a lot of chesed. He helped smuggle people out of the country. They would go through Turkey and then make their way to Israel. He was caught doing that. He was kicked out of the country, went to Iran, stayed there for a number of years. He actually managed to get an Iranian passport. And then he got permission to go back to Aleppo, take his family and his belongings, and leave. And he was one of the few people that actually had permission to take things out of Aleppo. So the night before he left, in 1958, two of the rabbis who knew where the codex was said, "We have an important mission for you. Are you willing to undertake it? You could risking your life by doing this. We need you to take this to Israel." And he said, "Yes." I spoke to his son, who was 8 years old and was there at the time. And what they did is they took the codex, I mean, it's about this big, and they wrapped it in a cheesecloth, and cheesemakers, and they put the cheesecloth inside a washing machine, a small hand washing machine, and they stuffed it together with some clothing and some vegetables, and they put the whole thing inside a large carpet and put it on top of their car, and they drove to the border, and there the customs officials actually stopped them and was about to go and check that very rug that where it was, and they had an argument at the border, and finally the soldier called headquarters and said, "Hudkurth Faham, just get him out of here, let him go," and he managed to go without being checked. He went to Turkey, had to stay there for some time. Mossad was involved in helping them get the transfer, and then got on a boat and arrived in Haifa. Yeah.
My wife's cousin was a military attaché at that time in Turkey. He was the one who brought it out.
He was involved. What's his name? Shamosh?
Pasal.
Oh, Pasal. Yeah. Pasal. Okay. Yeah. Right. He's mentioned in Mati Friedman's book. Oh, that's your cousin. Fantastic. Okay. Good. So it seems that the government did know about it. And when he gets to the port, he hands it over to the customs officials, and eventually the head of the customs agency hands it over to the president Yitzhak Ben Tzvi, and it goes to his institute, Machon Ben Tzvi, which housed many manuscripts and books, especially from all over the Sephardic world, and there the librarian was Meir Ben Ayahu. Somewhere between that, in those months, the first record we have of what was there is a book that was missing a third of it. Almost the entire Chumash and most of the Megillot are gone. And this is a huge mystery. Until today, nobody knows where they are or what happened to them. There are a bunch of different theories about it, and we can get into it a little bit more later. But the truth is that we're still looking out for it. It's likely that it's somewhere on the black market, and it may just turn up one day miraculously, which would be a great thing. But the truth is, don't be too sad about it, because even though we don't have all those pages, we do have, remember all that redundancy? So we actually can figure out all the letters that were in those missing pages. So for example, the word dakab, which appears in Sefer Dvarim, that part is missing, but we know from here that it had the word aleph. Now if you look at all these Tanakhs, they have hey, and all the Sefer Torah, in this building, I'm sure, and in most other places, also have Dalet Kath Hey in Sefer Dvarim. This wasn't true going back. A medieval Ashkenaz manuscripts actually had it right with an Aleph, but then somewhere along the way, they thought the Sfaradim had it better and changed it to a Hey, unfortunately. We still do know what was in all of those manuscripts. Now we still don't follow it. And the truth is, even in Aleppo, The Sefer Torah there didn't follow the Aleppo Codex. Okay, let me try to explain why. And I'll end with this one fascinating story. If you look back on the back page. There's Professor Kasuto, who I mentioned. When he went and saw the Aleppo Codex, he actually wrote in his notes that this is not the text that the Rambam used. And the reason he said that is because of Shirat HaAzinu. HaAzinu was written as a poem, right, in two columns. And in the Aleppo Codex, which we still have, this is here's copies, we have the end of Dvarim. If anybody wants to count the lines, you can double-check me later. Okay, but if you count the number of rows that are in the in Parasha in HaAzinu, they come out to 67 lines. Got it? If you look at any of your Sefer Torah here, and you count them, you'll find that there are 70 lines. Okay, now, this is very significant because the Aleppo Codex is the only codex, only biblical manuscript that has 67 lines. All the rest have 70, including the Leningrad manuscript. Now, if you read the Rambam, or second to last line, he says, Surat Shidat HaAzinu, Kol Shita V'Shita Yesh B'Em Tzadevach Echad Kesurat HaParashah Situma. You have to leave space in the middle. V'Nimsa Kol Shita Chalukim L'Shtayim. So there's two sections for each line. Kotvim Ota B'Shivim Shitot. And you write on 70 lines. And Kasuto saw this, and he counted the lines, and he says, the Rambam in Mishneh Torah wrote, there are 70 lines. In the Aleppo Codex, there are 67 lines. Therefore, the Rambam did not use this codex. He must have used some other codex. And he writes, he describes it before. The codex I use is the one that's ancient, the well-known one from Ben Asher. Sounds like it, but maybe there was another one. And then, a few years later, another brilliant scholar, Moshe Goshen Gottstein, said, hold it. Let's check the manuscript of the Mishneh Torah of the Rambam, which I have on the bottom, right? The Rambam's own manuscript. And it says here, Yesh b'em tzadevach echad kesurat ha-parasha situma v'nimsa nechleka l'shtayim bekotvin ota be'sheva v'shishim shitot. In fact, the Rambam has 67. What happened is some scribe was reading the Rambam and said, oh, 67, and noticed that his Sefer Torah had 70. So rather than fix his Sefer Torah, he fixed the Rambam. Okay, so we know now for sure that the Rambam did in fact use the Aleppo Codex and had 67 lines in his own Torah, and that was the basis of his book. But we can also tell from here that the Leningrad Codex did not have 70, and all of our Sefer Torah also have 70, which means that there is another very ancient tradition that also has 70. So even though the Aleppo Codex is the best, well, how do you define the best? One, the Rambam said it's the best. Two, it's the only Masoretic text that where the notes match the text 100%. Right? If it says it appears three times, it really appears three times. In the Leningrad Codex, for the second best, there are hundreds of mistakes. I mean, places that are not where it's not congruent. Okay. But even so, the truth is that the Aleppo Codex is the best, but still, there are other ancient traditions, and we can't tell for sure if the original Torah had 67 lines or 70 lines. The Rambam says that you should write all your Sefer Torah according to the Aleppo Codex, or else it's pasul. And people had a problem with that, and they actually asked this question to his son, Rabbeinu Avraham ben Harambam, who was in his own time was actually even greater, held in higher regard than the Rambam himself. He said, what should we do? And he said, as long as your Sefer Torah conforms with the majority of the Sefer Torah in your place, then you can assume that's an authentic tradition, and you don't have to follow the Aleppo Codex. Although, it's a good idea to do that as well, right? So the bottom line is that there are many places that we do have questions about exact spellings. All these things are, by the way, very minor points of Male and Chassid. You're not going to find any manuscript where it says "Thou shalt steal" or anything like that. Although, if you just change the Aleph to a Vav, and then, okay, law, right? So there are pretty minor differences. But I think what inspires me about the story is we can see all the great effort and time and care that these Baalei Mesorah put into preserving this text and making sure that we have it over centuries. And going back to the scribes of the Dead Sea Scrolls, who said, may hopefully one day someone will find this. And these scribes that devoted their whole life to making sure that every single letter, every single time will be the same. They felt the weight of the world is upon their efforts. And the least we could do, I guess, is to make sure to devote ourselves to studying each of those words and letters deriving all of their infinite meaning. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, 1 minute before everybody goes, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can take questions in a moment, but before everybody